All right, everybody, welcome back. This is technically episode 3 of Getting Stuff Done in Higher Education. As always, I'm Fritz Vandover, one of your 3 hosts, always joined by Kelvin Bentley and Kevin Schreiner. Say hey, guys.
Hey, how's it going?
Hey, Fritz. Hey, everyone.
Hey, everyone. Yeah. So continuing with our theme from last time, we're continuing with our get to know your hosts session. So today we have Kevin Schreiner. He's up. So as last time with Kelvin, we're going to talk about what has brought Kevin up to this moment, this day in his professional life and personal life, if you want to get into that. So Kevin, why are you here?
I'm here because I had a great introduction and opportunity to be with the two of you, which I just absolutely love. This is awesome. I am so glad that we're doing this. It's interesting when you hear someone else kind of like do their, where they've been and how they got here. And so listening to Kelvin talk about his pathway really started to make me think a little bit about how I kind of want to share this. Cause I think there's a lot in my youth background, like just my growing up background, that kind of shapes a little bit, probably like at least how I think about higher ed, not necessarily the role that I have in higher ed, but just how I've always thought about higher ed in general. So I'll start there. I am a Texan. I was born in El Paso, Texas. I literally have a certificate from the state of Texas with my birth certificate that says once a Texan, always a Texan. And so, you know, whether Texas decides to become its own country or whether or not it's going to stay a state, I am stuck in that world of being a Texan.
No judgment.
Now I'm, you know, and it's okay. I mean, it is who we are. But my dad was in the Army. So I was, my father was, or had already served probably about 5 years before I was born. And so I have an older brother and sister. So I was born in El Paso on the military base. My dad went to Vietnam in January. I was born in November, and in January he went to Vietnam. And so our family.
Are you going to share what year that was, Kevin? Or is that off limits?
No, I mean it's fine. I mean I have no shame as to how old I am. So I was born in 1969. So in January of 1970. So I mean, if you're a history person, like pretty much at the height of scorch and terror that was going on in Vietnam, where we were burning, trashing, bombing everything. And so in 1970, he went out to Vietnam, and clearly, I mean, I don't remember any of this, right? Like this is just things that I am aware of what happened. And so my mom, my brother, my sister, and myself, Fort Riley, which is in Kansas, had taken over an Air Force base in Salina, Kansas, that was used during World War II. And they made that basically a wives' barracks, wives and families' barracks.
And this is for families from all over the armed forces, right?
I think it is pretty much all over the armed forces. I don't know if it was, since it was connected with Fort Riley, and Fort Riley was the Big Red One, if there was a connection, like if your spouse got sent overseas and you were in the Big Red One, you weren't going to stay, like we weren't going to stay in El Paso. So, but that's a great question that I honestly, I don't know the answer to. So we were there for a year. In those barracks, there's a couple books that have been written on the women that lived through that experience and what it was like to not want to see a car come driving down the road and tell them that their husband, was not coming home, or they were not coming home alive. They were potentially coming home in a box. And so I think, you know, that early piece, and not necessarily, you know, just the fact that my dad went to Vietnam, but I grew up in essence in you know, the Vietnam Cold War era, and had an opportunity when I was, 5th to 7th grade. We lived in Germany for 3 years. And so we actually like Czechoslovakia was still a country. Yugoslavia was still a country. So they would do these exercises in the military. It's called Reforger. And you would do it right on the border of Czechoslovakia and Germany. And basically it's just showing military might. So the U.S. Army's there with all their howitzers and their tanks, and they're running them all over the ground and stuff. But when we took this little dirt road ride out by the fences, and there's literally a sign that just says landmines next 50 yards. Then there's this barbed wire fence, and then there's space, and then there's another barbed wire fence. And then that's the Czechoslovakian Russian side with a tower of some, you know, with a Russian in that tower watching everything that's going on, just waiting, you know, for stuff to happen.
And so this is late '70s, early '80s. I mean, this is vivid memories. This isn't foggy memories. This is your early.
Yeah, no. So, I mean, for me, I mean, this would have been, I mean, so my brother graduated in 83. So this would have been 79, 80 to 83. Mm-hmm. And I think in 82 is when we were actually in Fulda, Germany, F-U-L-D-A, on the border of Czechoslovakia, watching all the army stuff going on. So my dad was a mechanic, engineer. And so basically he worked on the tanks, built, you know, fixed the diesel trucks and all those types of things when they broke down and stuff. And so he wasn't necessarily doing military component, you know, like he wasn't firing a gun and all that stuff, but clearly trained to be able to do all those things. But so that, I think, you know, so I share all that because I think in part, having grown up in the military, like, so just to kind of like, just real quick. So from Salina, Kansas, when my dad came back from Vietnam, we then went to, actually, I don't know if we spent a year in Texas first, like around the Fort Worth area. And then we went to Alaska, but we ended up in Alaska. So we're in Alaska for about 3 or 4 years. And then we went to Louisiana, Fort Polk, which is close to Northwestern. Louisiana. So funny, total funny side story. So like wrestling was a huge thing, right? Like Hulk Hogan, all those, like all the, like the mega wrestlers, like, so this was 77, 78, 79. Like that was like the big, like people actually went to wrestling events and saw these wrestlers in arenas and all this stuff. And I remember we were driving from home to, it was either Alexandria or DeRidder. I think it was Alexandria. To watch a wrestling match, and it came on the news that Elvis Presley died, and my mom about lost it, like huge Elvis, like, but like, I mean, like, so stuff like that, right? Like, so it's like, but anyways, so I share all that to say, you know, going from Alaska to Louisiana to Germany, and then when we left Germany, we came back to El Paso, which is when my dad retired. It's just all those experiences I had when I was young, right? Like living, like having an opportunity to live in not only a different country and experiencing a different country, but even just different parts of the U.S. And what it was, I mean, I learned French when I was in Louisiana, right? Like most people are learning Spanish in grade school because, you know, France actually was in Louisiana, right? The Louisiana Purchase. Oh, yeah. You learn French, Creole, right? And so it was, so like all those types of things were just interesting and different. So anyways, kind of speeding up a little bit. So when my dad retired from El Paso, both my mom and my dad were from Kansas. And so they decided to retire back into the town that my mom grew up in. And so I did my sophomore year through my senior year in that town. At that same time, my dad passed away when I was a junior in high school. And here's the full connection. His tour in Vietnam took him 20 years to die from that tour, mm-hmm. from Agent Orange.
Yeah, we talked about that when we were at the conference. Oh. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, when you start to think about like people that are coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan and all those things that people go through. I mean, war is just not hell when you're in war. War is hell when you're back from war, and the things that you don't know that's happening to you. And so,
and then, not to jump in, but to the impact on kids and other generations, it's real. And we'll get into this, my experience with that when in my episode, but yeah, it's, you see it and you feel it. And it affects your day to day.
Yeah. Yeah. And so I've always kind of had, I've had this military history, like for my entire life, right. Has been the military in some sense. So living on base, living off base, you know, all those types of things. And so, when I graduated high school, I really thought I was going to be a wildlife biologist. That was what I wanted to do. Had the opportunity when I was in high school to spend some time with the Kansas Department of Wildlife and Parks. We went out and shocked fish to do a fish count. We transferred turkeys from one location to another. We dropped fresh trout into this stream in November. So it was like one of those career exploration type weeks. So that's what I was going to do, but had no idea where I was going to go. My brother, who's about 4 years older than me, when we ended up back in El Paso, he was kind of like, wasn't really for sure what he wanted to do. So he took a couple of classes from, the community college in El Paso, and still really hadn't quite, my sister was just, so when I was in eighth grade, my sister was graduating, high school. And so she went back to Kansas State. So it was like right away, she knew where she was going to go. So she took off to Kansas State. When we got back to Kansas, my brother, who in high school ran cross country, went out to Colby Community College on a cross country scholarship and did physical therapist assistant. And so that was the degree path that he chose. And has been a physical therapist assistant his entire life. And so for me, I was, and again, so I think, so also kind of going back, first generation, right? So clearly, I mean, my father did not attend school or college beyond high school. My mother did not attend college beyond high school. And that's another story I'll get into because I think it's really unique. And so so in high school, I did tennis and I did track. So I did tennis for 2 years, went to state both of those years, both in singles and doubles. And then in my senior year, between my junior year and my senior year, they had this workout summer, right? So if you were an athlete or if you were a non-athlete or whatever, you could use the gym at the high school and you could lift weights and all these types of things. And of course, it was always, you know, the football coach that's running it and stuff. And so we did sprints, me and this other person that was there that morning. We had to do a 40-yard dash. And he does his, and then the coach is like, all right, ready, set, go. And I do mine. And he's just looking at it. And he's looking at me. He goes, do you want to do that again? I'm like, yeah, I can do it again. So I ran it again. He's like, that's a 4.3. And he's just like looking at me like, because I mean, if you know me, I have long, lanky legs. I mean, I'm not built like most typical sprinters. Mm-hmm. But honestly, I think my time on the tennis court like shaped like because you
it's all your fast twitch muscles.
There's a lot of moving back and forth on a tennis court. I mean, you got to get to the net. You got to get back. Like you're running more than I think most people think that you're running. So anyways, he's like, you should do football. And I'm like, I'm not playing football. And plus it's a small town. Like I graduated the town. There was 52 kids in my class when we graduated. Most of those people grew up, like you already know who the quarterback's going to be. You know who's playing what positions, cause they've just done it their entire lives. Yeah. Like, no, I'm not playing football. But I did go out for track. And so my senior year, I ran track, ran the 100, 200, 400 and the 4x1. And I believe we still, the four of us that ran the 4x1, I believe still have the record for the fastest 4x1 at the school. So anybody that's from Ellsworth, Kansas, that want to call me up and correct me on that, feel free to do so. But I believe that's the case.
We can do that. This can happen. We can do
that. I don't think there's any records going back to 1988. So then I was like, okay, what am I going to do? So not really knowing, I did dual enrollment in high school. my senior year, in part because there's a big difference between curriculum in El Paso, Texas, and curriculum in Ellsworth, Kansas. I had already taken history my freshman year. In Kansas, you don't take history until your junior year. Like, right, there's a path that there are certain courses you take at certain times and all these types of things. Mm-hmm. I'd already done all of that. I'd already had my foreign language. I'd already taken the lower level freshman. I was always one year ahead. I took algebra in eighth grade. So I was 1 year ahead in math going into my ninth grade year.
So you're getting primed with all this. You're getting primed with advanced level curricular materials,
courses. Yeah. Not to brag or anything, Fritz, but I've been considered a gifted child my entire life, which is also, that's a whole nother story for another day.
It is. I bet we can all relate to that too.
So I was always ahead.
I wasn't in a gifted program.
But when I got to Germany in fifth grade, I was put in a total, I was almost in the sixth grade because I was so far ahead in math and reading than anybody else in the fifth grade. So when I got to El Paso requires you to take Texas history in the seventh grade. Mm-hmm. Clearly, I didn't take it because I was in Germany. So I had to take history and Texas history my eighth grade year. But the teacher in my Texas history's class, he's just like, basically, I was just like the tutor for everybody else in class. He's like, you already know all this. Like, and so, but then I took algebra. And so I was already ahead. So I already had, so I was in geometry in ninth grade. And so then when I got to Kansas, there was no math left when I got to my senior year. So I did dual enrollment and we took, I think it was college algebra that we took. But anyway, so I did dual. I mean, so it's interesting, you know, to think about all the higher ed things that you're kind of, that you see and you're involved with now that you don't really think about as a student then. It's like, yeah, I mean, I took dual enrollment in 1988. Like, why is this such a big deal that we have these conversations around the value of dual enrollment? It's like, I did it.
So a question. Yeah. I wanted to,
yeah.
So dual enrollment, did you go to a campus for this dual enrollment or was it more like, AP?
No, it was actual dual enrollment. It was college credit. So I have three credits from Barton County Community College for college algebra. It was taught by our math teacher. So our math teacher, so Barton County, you kind of got to know the layout of Kansas. So Barton County's Great Bend. Great Bend is probably like 30-minute drive from Ellsworth. But our math teacher taught us the college algebra class. And there's other stuff I'm not going to talk about on this podcast, but there's other things like you think you get a college, like trying to do a college experience. Like there was three of us that were in that class, probably did some things that we probably shouldn't have done in that class, but is what it is.
He's retired, but you know,
it's not necessarily what he did. It's more of what I did or what we did. And it's just like, yeah. Another day over cocktails, maybe. No, I don't think necessarily. Yeah,
those are the secret digital badges, right? That we're not going to talk
shadow
about.
Badges. Yeah. Yes,
it was
shadow docket.
It was. So then I graduated high school, and actually I went to Colby. So I got a track and cross country scholarship to go to Colby Community College. So I'm a first generation community college graduate transfer student, if you kind of keep track of some of those things. So I did my 2 years at Colby, met my beautiful wife at Colby. She was also as a physical therapist assistant, did the physical therapist assistant program. She was Angela. I should just say her name. Angela was born and raised in Kansas. Her dad was soybean corn farmer right outside of Topeka, small town of Rossville. So she graduated high school from Manhattan, Kansas, but anyways, ended up at Colby, and we connected at Colby. And I will just say that's 36 years ago that we've been, or 36 years that we've been together, 35 years married next year.
That's great. Congrats. Early congrats.
Yes.
35 this? No, yeah, it's next year.
You need to know this. Now it's getting out there.
We already had a 34. So 35.
I can cut this out of the. I promise Kevin knows his anniversary dates and years.
Yeah, no, it's just trying to think. You know, I get lost sometimes on what year it actually is. And so it will be 35 next year. Wow. We got married in 91.
That's great.
Yeah.
So when you. This is not really a question. It's interesting about your time in Kansas, you know, how your family spent some time there. Interesting enough, I spent some time in Manhattan, Kansas as well.
I know. That's like, I was making all these connections when you were doing your thing. Like I did consulting at Northwestern when I worked for EAB. Like it's really weird, right? Like,
yeah, we're connected in a lot of different ways, you know, like Kevin, Kelvin, the right similarities in name. Grew up around the same time. We could maybe do our own version of Ebony and Ivory as
karaoke at some point. I can actually play that pretty well on a piano. So if you guys want to do that,
we should.
That would be good.
I think that would be amazing. So, I appreciate you kind of spending more time talking about your time in Kansas because, you know, I did my pre-doctoral internship, at K-State for a year and didn't really know anyone there, but the people there that I met were really nice. The ice cream on campus was amazing.
Yep. Tall Hall.
You know, from someone from Detroit, you know. I didn't have easy access to Michigan State, so where their ice cream is also very good as a state university. But.
Yeah. Yeah. I think we can debate ice cream. I have actually had this conversation at EPSIA last week. Because folks were talking about ice cream at different places and someone had been to Nebraska, and nothing against University of Nebraska ice cream. I will still hands down say Manhattan, Kansas, Call Hall ice cream is the bomb. Nobody can compare.
Isn't Penn State known for theirs too?
Yes.
Yeah. Yes. Okay.
I think if you had a sampling of all of them in a, K-States would rise, that would be the cream of the top.
That's a challenge I'd love to take because I love ice cream. So
yeah.
I would happily be your blind taste tester.
There you go.
I can take the bias out of it because you probably can peg it right away just tasting it. So
honestly, probably not. I think it's just more of a bias of being an alum. And
but, so, okay.
Oh, yeah.
I'm interested in what took you, like I said, your first generation college student.
Yep.
What compelled you? Because this is the mid to late 80s. So, I mean, the post-war boom has ended-ish, you know, early 80s. We've got inflation, unemployment, yada, yada.
Yep.
So I'm not saying we didn't have a manufacturing economy, but what pulled you towards a college path versus a similar-ish path to your, well, maybe to your dad or to the communities in which you grew up?
You know, that's an interesting question. And I really never thought about it other than the Army right out of college for me was not a choice.
And was that because of your dad's experience in Vietnam?
I don't know. I don't know if it was more of just I lived it for 16 years. Like it's hard to separate, even though you're not in the Army, it's hard to separate. You're living basically in the Army during that time when you're growing up. And so I don't know if subconsciously or consciously, like that was the decision. I think having seen my brother go to school and my sister go to school,
I think, and again,
small town, 52 people in my class. I think a majority of us went to college, like in some capacity. But I think what was nice about my choice was nobody was like, oh my God, he's going to Colby. Like he's going to a community college. Like there was none of that type of conversation. Like why are they, you know, I had a lot of my classmates went to community colleges. I have a good friend who went and played basketball on a basketball scholarship at a community college. So, and I think that's the other thing that's probably a little bit different when you think about a little bit of the community college structure in Kansas at the time And I think it's kind of evolving a little bit more in other places. But athletics was a big thing for the community colleges. I mean, you had baseball, softball, track, cross country, basketball, men's and women's basketball. You had football at some of them. And I didn't realize this until I got to the University of Arkansas. Barton County Community College, which is in the Wichita area of Kansas, was actually a feeder school for a lot of SEC states. So back then, if you didn't score high enough on your ACTs or your SATs and you wanted to play football, you weren't eligible through the NCAA to go to school. And so they would, these coaches would contact these coaches at these community colleges. And I think Texas is a little bit like this with the community college structure, but they would send these players to the community colleges to get their grades up,
yep,
or so they could be admitted based on their grades, since they weren't admitted based on their test scores. And then they would come back through. And I didn't realize that until I got to Arkansas and was processing applications and stuff. And it's just like, why are all these athletes come from the same school? And it's just like, oh, duh, it's a feeder.
This is a potential tangent, but it's really interesting. I mean, I don't know how much it's like that now. I mean, so I'm from St. Louis. I'm a big Cardinals fan still. Albert Pujols was, you know, an iconic player. He went to a community college, and then he's drafted like 9,000th in whatever year that was.
Yeah.
But, you know, so community colleges, there's a long history of being places to recruit college or collegiate and even professional athletes. They,
yeah,
you know, they skip over the baccalaureate college, 4-year university, et cetera. But it's an interesting topic.
Yeah. I mean, I didn't realize until I went to community college. I mean, it's the National Junior College Athletic Association, right? Like who knew? I didn't. I mean, you don't read about it. You don't think about it. I mean, again, other than, you know, my brother had gone, he knew the coach. And so it was kind of like, well, you know, why not? So that's what I did. And I think my 2 years at K-State, so my goal before I met my beautiful wife was I was going to do 2 years at K-State. And then I was going to go to North Dakota State University and finish their baccalaureate program in wildlife biology. Like that was, like, I had already all that planned out in my head. That was the direction I was going to go. When I got to Colby, really just, and I think even just being around different people, like Colby's, it's the most Western community college in the state of Kansas. It's very close to the Colorado border and the northwest corner. Rural farming, agriculture, like they had an ag unit. Like I was in a residence hall with everybody that wore shit kickers and I'm wearing tennis shoes, right? Like everybody had cowboy boots on. Everybody was going to the one of the guys in there, Jeff, I'll never forget, like big dude, like 6'2", probably like 300 pounds. I mean, Jeff was freaking awesome and hilarious, but he's a sheep farmer. And so he would go out to the farm or the community college and, hey, you want to go out this morning? We're going to pop sheep out, you know, lambs out of the sheep. It's breeding time and stuff. And it's like, sure, why not? So, you know, you start to learn things, like you see things and you experience things that you didn't really experience even in a small town. Cause like, unless you lived on a farm, you weren't doing those types of things.
Yeah.
You know, I had an opportunity when I was little coming back and forth to Kansas to go through wheat harvest and, you know, experience those types of things. But I mean, I probably lived being like a pseudo farmer for 2 years, which was fun. It was cool.
Mm-hmm.
But taking all those courses and stuff, and then again, meeting Angela, I don't know if that necessarily totally changed my direction of what I wanted to do, but started to see that there were other types of programs. And so there was a program at Kansas State called Park Resource Management, where you basically could learn to manage national parks, state parks, closely aligned to wildlife biology, but not necessarily wildlife biology. And then I worked 2 summers. I worked the summer between my freshman year and sophomore year and my sophomore year and junior year at Wilson State Park from Memorial Day to about a week and a half after Labor Day, basically working in the park, doing what you, I mean, I was primarily picking up trash and mowing lawns and those types of things, but just the experience there of working with people in that field really kind of shifted. And so that's what I transferred to K-State to do. So I transferred to K-State And with an AS degree, all of my credits transferred. Did not have to take anything extra at K-State to graduate.
As it should be.
As it should be. I know. But it's funny, like it was an AS. It wasn't an AA. It was an Associate of Science and General Science degree program. So I get to K-State. While at K-State, kind of thinking more about, and so also at this point in time, getting married at some point in 91. I graduated in 92. We got married the end of my junior year. Kind of like trying to figure out what I want to do, how and stuff. And so you start to look at jobs in this area. $13,000 a year, $14,000 a year, you know, the idea of going and working at Yellowstone, you know, and maybe you get housing, but you're still not making above the poverty level with a bachelor's degree. It was kind of like, it's appealing, but it's not that appealing. So the more you start to look at other jobs, you're like, oh, you know, people that have really good jobs in the national park system have master's degrees, or they have a degree in history or something like that. So I did a unofficial minor in history while I was finishing my baccalaureate degree in park resource management. And the reason I didn't do a minor, two different colleges, and I didn't want to have to meet the arts and sciences requirement. So I just talked to my advisor, and I'm like, I want to take as many history courses as I can for my electives. He's like, go for it. Go ahead, do it. So that's what I did. So this is the life-changing moment right here. So I took a course in African American history. And in that course, I learned, I had a lot of opportunities to learn a lot of things, but I really honed in on the Buffalo Soldiers, which were men of the 9th and 10th Cavalry that were created right after the end of the Civil War in segregated military units. And that the reason that I kind of honed in on them was they were stationed in Fort Riley. And so Fort Riley is literally like 25 minutes from Manhattan. Mm-hmm. The 10th Cavalry was physically formed at the end of the Civil War in Fort Leavenworth, which is also in Kansas. Mm-hmm. So it's at the height of the Indian Wars, right? Like people moving west, Santa Fe Trail, Oregon Trail, all those types of things. But the more I did research on them, the 9th Cavalry was stationed in Fort Harker, which was a fort 15 minutes from Ellsworth, which I didn't know that. I mean, you don't see there's no sign when you go to Fort Harker that says, hey, the 9th Cavalry and 10th Cavalry used to be stationed here. They were stationed in Fort Larned, which is further west, because that was the military trail. So there was a military trail that went from Fort Leavenworth to Fort Riley to Harker to Larned. And then ultimately the people in that military trail ended up in Colorado Springs, Denver, slightly north of the Santa Fe Trail. So the Santa Fe Trail came out of Fort Leavenworth and really kind of took a big divergence south down towards Oklahoma. But that the 9th and 10th Cavalry supported those individuals riding on that. But here was the big shocker for me. So if you're familiar with history at all, especially the 9th and 10th, Armstrong Custer, who ended up Lieutenant General of the 7th Cavalry, had an opportunity to be the white leader of the 9th Cavalry and turned it down when he was in Fort Riley, and decided to take a lower commission with the 7th Cavalry. And we all know that fate, right? Little Bighorn. The 9th Cavalry and the 7th Cavalry were stationed at Fort Riley at the same time. And I had already read this book by Leakey, The Buffalo Soldiers. And so I knew a little bit of this information already. But in my class, I had an opportunity to go to the museum and the library of Fort Riley. And I read the quartermaster reports. Like what they actually hand wrote is in this library. I had to put on white gloves and everything. It's like the first time really touching like old documents. And William Leakey's notes are all over this thing. Like he had been there, like part of his research in his book is there, his yellow pages of notes. He left all the stuff that he wrote. And so I was kind of flipping through the pages and stuff. And there's this one part. There was a cholera. I can't remember if it was a cholera or an influenza epidemic, but something came through and killed many people that were in Fort Riley, women, children, and members of the 7th and 9th Cavalry. Mm-hmm. In the quartermaster's reports, in these actual physical documents that you can read, there's a cemetery, and you can go see it. There's a cemetery in Fort Riley. It's the old cemetery. There's a slight hill, and it has a tree on the top. At the top of that hill and around the tree are members of the 7th Cavalry. They're buried there. You follow it down. At the bottom of this hill are members of the 9th Cavalry, which is like, okay. But when you read the quartermaster's reports, it specifically says, we're going to bury the 7th Cavalry at the top of the hill and the 9th Cavalry at the bottom of the hill so the blood of the 9th Cavalry doesn't taint the blood of the 7th Cavalry in death.
Wow.
So not only were they segregated in service, they were segregated in death. That blew my mind, mm-hmm. right? Like, that was just like, holy cow. And I think for me, and so I just started reading more and more and more about military, African-American history. So Willard Gatewood, who was at the University of Arkansas, wrote a book called Smoke Yankees, which is about the time the Spanish-American War, where the sinking of the Maine and the cause of the sinking of the Maine, but then the soldiers that came down from 23rd Infantry and the 9th Cavalry, how they were segregated out of the city of Key West, how they were segregated out of the city of Tampa. Like, they were there to protect from rioters and all this other stuff. They couldn't carry guns. So they were restricted from the things that they could do, but they couldn't handcuff a white person. They definitely could not touch a white woman. Like, there's just a lot in all of that. And so for me,
sounds like it was shocking to you in that, not unlike many people, that especially because where you grew up in the South, mm-hmm. all that kind of knowledge and history was never acknowledged, kept separate, so that seeing this and encountering it is stunning.
You think back to like what we learned, I didn't learn any of that stuff in high school.
No.
I would even have considered myself like a history buff in high school. Like, I love reading history stuff.
Oh, yeah.
But
you ended up getting a master's in it, didn't you?
Yeah, so that's kind of where this is going. But I still didn't read any of that stuff. I mean, even when I took Texas history, there was nothing in the Texas history book about the service of the 9th and 10th Cavalry and what they did during that time period and nothing. So part of it was like really eye-opening and part of it was like really disturbing, right? Like, mm-hmm. especially when you put on the lens of, I grew up in the military. I remember going fishing with my dad and people he worked with. They were Black. They were Hispanic. They were like, there was no like, and so like this whole idea that the, and not even knowing that the military was segregated up until 1950, right? Like, I would have never even thought that that was even something that was even possible. Yeah. So that whole, honestly, I will say my African American history course that I took at Kansas State University is what put me on a trajectory really for where I am. Like that whole class is what made me go do a master's degree. And so I actually sought out where Willard Gatewood was, didn't realize he was at Arkansas. So I applied to I think three schools. I applied to Oklahoma State, Arkansas, and I think Oklahoma. Maybe I may have applied to KU, but I don't think I did.
To a master's program specifically?
to a master's program. No, okay. To a master's program. So this is where the gifted stuff comes back to bite you in the ass. My grades were not great as an undergrad. Like, I just have a hard time like staying focused on things that I think I already know or can get from somewhere else. Like, I had poor attendance in class. Like, I mean, we could go all kinds of things around that, but it was, yeah. So I was lucky to get into Arkansas, I think. And so when I went to Arkansas, I got invited down. So they interviewed me. So I went down to Fayetteville. I met Elliot West, who is like the historian of the West. So it's funny, his last name's West, and he's the historian of the West. Mm-hmm. And I had read some of his books too. It's just like, I don't think I remember at all in my undergrad reading a book that one of my professors wrote. And so here I am now, the opportunity to study with Willard Gatewood, who has like three books that I wrote, Elliot West, who has a book that I wrote. And I was like, I really hope this is where I end up. And lucky for me, that's where I ended up. And so I worked with Willard Gatewood. I worked with Nudie Williams, who wrote a lot about African-American cowboys in the West. And so he has a lot of work from Oklahoma and how Black individuals were able to get into that type of space and really have the freedom that they didn't have in other places. So he was my master's thesis chair. So I did my whole master's degree. My emphasis is in African American history, though it's just an American history degree. I wrote my thesis on, and I've always debated, I really should go back and change the title. I wrote it as African Americans in the Colonial Militias. They really weren't they weren't Americans then. I should really say slaves or blacks. Mm-hmm. The Colonial Militias. But what I did was, there's a lot of history that's also been written around that, but there's a lot of primary sources. And so I tried to go and look at the primary sources and interpret them the way that I think what they were trying to say, versus some people, you know, again, you can read primary sources and go, well, this is what they really meant. But really kind of honed in on how flippy floppy the colonials were when it came to using blacks and when they were going to arm the blacks and what purpose they were going to have. And it's just like, you know, the minute they were going to get overrun by 1,000 marauding Indians, oh, let's give them guns and let them die. I mean, you know, it's just like this flip of the, yeah. And then take them all away and, you know, put them back into the fields and all this stuff. But a lot of it had to do, like, there's a lot of other things in there, like just the population of slaves in South Carolina and Georgia versus the number of white people that lived in those states. And so that's what my goal was after with the master's degree. For, I think entering, I still thought I was going to go to work at Gettysburg or.
Okay. I was going to ask, what was your intent in getting a master's besides its own? You were intensely interested in it, but.
Yeah, that's where I started. Like, that was my goal going in, was I was going to be a superintendent of Gettysburg, right. Or something. I was going to work at a national park, military national park. But then I started thinking, the more I got into it, I was like, teaching would be interesting. And the reason teaching became interesting was I did tutoring at Veterans Upward Bound. I did tutoring in the athletics and in the athletic department. Mm-hmm. And so tutoring kind of like spurred this, you know, you can actually you become, you know, a teacher. You could, and I didn't want to teach at K-12. So I thought I was going to go to a community college and teach at a community college. I was familiar with community colleges. Towards the end of my program, sending out resumes and no interviews, no nothing. So then
it's kind of the early 90s, mid 90s.
So this would have been, I graduated with my master's in the summer of 94. So I started, I graduated K-State December of 92, started January of 93 at Arkansas and finished my master's degree in a year and a half.
Can I ask some technical questions?
Yeah.
Our paths are very similar and we'll talk more in my time, but did you get funding for that master's or did you have to pay out of pocket?
I paid for my master's. I loaned my master's is probably a better way to say it.
Yeah.
No wonder they were happy to welcome you in despite your thinking your grades kept you out.
There weren't, I don't, to my knowledge, the only people that were really getting funding at Arkansas were the PhD students. There were very few master's students that were getting any sort of funding. And so then, you know, not getting opportunities, not getting jobs and those types of things coming my way, really started looking about, okay, well, what are you going to do? And so my wife at the same time is kind of like, what are you going to do?
Because you already had your first child by then, didn't you?
I did. So Callie was born in January of 94. Yeah.
That'll light a fire.
Yeah. So in part, that was part of it too. So I wished every dad had this opportunity. You know, I basically spent the first 6 months of her life. I was the person at home. I mean, I was doing I would go to school at night. I would do my my schoolwork, you know, I would stay up later and do my schoolwork, but I was her caregiver for her first 6 months. So yeah, I mean, it was great. But it's also that realization is like, okay, it's time to, you know, you got to do something. So really started just looking around in Fayetteville. It's like, we weren't really interested in leaving right away. Angela had a great job. Callie, we had a good church community. Like, we were connected with community and all these types of things. We weren't looking to leave. And I took whatever job I could get at the university. And my first job was as a data entry clerk in the admissions office, processing undergraduate applications. And funny story is, this is 1994. In 1993, they had just stopped doing punch card mainframe data. Oh my. Like, this was like brand new student information system stuff. But this is also, it's like, If you know where I've been and stuff, like, here's the little pieces that start to come together and yep. stuff. It's like, oh, Kevin's got a jobs data entry, new student information system. So what does Kevin end up doing? Kevin ends up being the person who's training everybody and writing the processes and improving our processes and how to use these new systems and stuff. Because, like, you know, here's the 20-something-year-old that can figure out how computers work and things like that. And it actually was really interesting, right? Like, that was like the aha that there's something else here. But so we spent three years at Arkansas. After that, I went on Arkansas through being an employee. I did my master's degree in higher ed administration, student personnel services. So then moved up through the ranks in admissions, became a road warrior, went out recruiting undergraduate students. And funny enough, I was responsible for recruiting Native American students from Oklahoma and Black students. So I was part of the minority affair recruiting component of the University of Arkansas, in addition to my Northeast Arkansas territories. So did that for about 2 years. Then Angela and I decided, and so... also our second child on the way, Angela and I decided that we wanted to move to Florida. She had a really good friend that she worked with. Her husband was an air traffic controller. She was a physical therapist. They had moved to Fort Myers. And it's like, you know, why not? Why not just, like, let's just go somewhere totally different. Actually got offered an opportunity at Florida Atlantic University. Their Palm Beach, North Palm Beach office, where they were building an honors college. To start building their admissions, their transfer, like the things that they were doing. So I did that for really just about a year. And then Walden University had an office in Bonita Springs, Florida, which is right by Fort Myers. Early years of online. So I took that job as an associate director for recruitment. That was my first foray into really writing a recruitment plan, a model for recruitment, like the strategy behind recruitment, being responsible and accountable for actually revenue generation. So, like, that was that first aha. So this was 1999. First foray into that. Also, though, at the same time, Walden University is implementing DataTel as a student information system. Mm. Who gets tasked to be part of the DataTel implementation? Kevin does. Mm-hmm. Made some really good connections with DataTel. And a year later, I jumped ship from higher ed into, you know, the corporate higher education space and did student information system implementations for the next year and a half.
So this is one thing I find really interesting. And I hear this a lot, at least people of our generation in higher education. So, you know, folks who graduate from college in the early, mid, late 90s, is that
us Gen Xers?
Gen X all the way, baby. I don't have a degree in computer science, et cetera. Neither of you two do, but somehow, honestly, it seems like it's because there was so much demand. Few people, there are a lot of people who study comp sci and all that stuff from my cohort. I knew lots of folks. But not many people who at least had a nascent understanding of higher ed that could put it together in a way that, you know, they could get things through the the culture, help build things in the way that we're informed by the organization. So,
yeah.
So I'm hearing that from you too. And Kelvin, I know. So somehow you become, we, people like us, like, oh, you're the tech person who knows how to implement this stuff, or you, whether it's in teaching or research or administration or just function and business enterprise. I don't know what it's like now. I don't know if that, or everyone's so specialized, you got to come out with this, this, and this to slot you right in. It seems very linear now. It was very meandering, and I'm hearing that from you too. You didn't back your way in, like you just fell into it, but you, it was a very indirect path to data tell, from master's in American history to data tell in less than 10 years, 5 years, seven years, eight, you know, like that's.
Yeah. I mean, I graduated in 94 and in 99, I was, 5 years. I mean, I was at data tell. What's interesting, I mean, I know it is an interesting path. Like you don't really, but I think it's almost like the willing, it's like people who are willing to learn it and do it. I mean, that's where I learned change management. That's where I learned like all my consulting practices that I know.
In those first years or at data tell?
At data tell.
Gotcha.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, those, cause I mean, I did student information systems for about 5 years, two different companies, but for about 5 years. But all of my, like, so I learned enrollment management at Arkansas, right? So our VP was a NOLEP. So before Ruffalo NOLEVITS, he was a NOLEVITS consultant. And so learned all of the components of like how the funnel works, how you communicate with students. Like, I mean, good God, in 1996, I mean, I was sending birthday cards to students in my territory. Like that was our personalization. Like people today, like, it's funny how things like cycle. Like it takes about 20 years and a new thing cycles back again. It's like, oh, we should be personalizing things and we should be sending. It's like, I was doing that in the early 90s.
You're saying that personalization is the skinny jeans, the return of skinny jeans for higher admissions?
Yeah, I think it is. Like sending birthday cards to prospective students saying, hey, happy birthday. Thinking about you. Hope you're going to be a Razorback soon.
But now it's at a volume where that doesn't penetrate. Maybe if you mailed one in person, but there's so much volume. Like, my daughter's 16 and she's just going to be a junior. The volume of communications she already gets from schools, it's just noise, I think.
Yeah.
At least to me, it is.
Yeah. No, I agree. I mean, I think we've gotten to a point where personalization is just oversending of things to people. But so got into the whole student information system thing, traveled a lot. Then there was a job opportunity in Cape Coral where we lived to actually run to be the director of education for a company that did real estate and financial investment training. And they were, so basically it was at that time. So this would have been 2004 to 2007, but that was my first, that was really my, Walden was a foray into online, but Walden really still wasn't truly online. Because of the way that they did their system, and they had mandatory, you have to go to DC for meetings and
low residencies.
Low residency, but there was also no LMS, right? Like it was just, you got an email from your professor. They operated what they used to call KAMs, which is knowledge area module. And basically you'd be given a module that you're going to work on. You do all the work. You send your paper to your professor. Your professor reads it and goes, no, this isn't quite what we're looking for, you know. And then until you pass that, then you move to the next knowledge area. And then you move to the next knowledge area. And then ultimately you get your degree. But it really wasn't online. You weren't interacting with other people.
Yeah, it's like correspondence mixed with a bit of early competency-based ed.
Yeah. Interesting. The whole thing, I mean, we had a ton of military people that were doing it, especially in our business program. So I started doing that, and I brought in all my higher ed expertise, like into this corporate world. So enrollment management. So people would sign up for all of these trainings and pay these thousands of dollars for these trainings, but then nobody was calling them to get them scheduled to go to the training and to get them into the classes. And basically the way that works is, from a financial perspective, if you're a company, you can't recognize any of that revenue until somebody actually sits and takes that class. So they're sitting on hundreds of thousands, millions of dollars of unallocated revenue that they can't recognize, that because people haven't gone to training. So set up all that stuff to try to get people to go through training. And we started using WebEx for some stuff. So we started doing some online stuff. And so we started using WebEx as the way to deliver that education. But what I also did was I had all those teachers, trainers, create DVDs. And I was like, we're going to just start sending DVDs to people. And the CEO's like, yeah, let's do that. And so the minute we sent DVDs, we sent one a month. Like if you signed up, every month you're going to get a DVD until you came to class. You could still come to a live class, but the DVD was our recognition. We gave them their training. So now we can recognize that revenue. So I brag all the time that, I mean, I made like $55 million for this company because mm-hmm. they had unrecognized revenue. It's like, boom, overnight recognized. So Edison Community College at the time was right there in Fort Myers. They had a job for an institutional research person, and I took that job just so I could get out of the environment I was in, but had a really good run at Edison, which later became Florida Southwestern, 5 years. I don't even think I was a director. I think I was just an institutional research analyst and ended up as an associate dean when I left. But that's, so I'm a late bloomer on the on the doctoral side. That's when I started my doctoral degree when I was at Edison. Because I started a certificate at Florida State, an institutional research certificate at Florida State. And I was like halfway through, I did like 9 of the 18 credits. And I'm like, why am I doing a certificate when I can just go get my doctorate? Mm-hmm. So I actually applied to AIR, the Association for Institutional Research, and got a fellowship with AIR and the National Center for Education Statistics to do my doctorate. Mm-hmm. So I did my doctorate at Nova, able to not have to travel anywhere, did online, majority of it was online. They had a campus in Fort Myers where we did some of our face-to-face classes, really good experience, loved my dissertation. So I did it on students in students that are in developmental courses and the impact that enrolling in non-developmental courses has on their success. So in other words, if you are developmental in math, but you take a history course, are you more apt to be successful in college because you're not just enrolled in these developmental courses your entire beginning part of your career? Or are there certain courses that we can interweave to get you engaged in the college environment, the college credit area, while you're doing these? And so basically the data demonstrates that for math students, it is. For writing and reading students, not so much. Like, because there's so much other courses that require reading.
Writing and reading.
And writing. That you've got to get through that first. But so that was my dissertation. When I finished my dissertation, 2012, I kind of bought into the whole idea that, you know, you have a doctorate, you can go change the world, you can go do whatever the hell you want. So I basically quit Edison, took a dean of academic affairs job at a college in Boca, which was a predominantly online on-campus program. Did not work out well for our relationship. And then kind of went into this consulting world. Spent a year and a half at Ave Maria doing their institutional effectiveness, helping them get ready for SACS, COC. Became an assistant professor at Argosy University during that same time teaching, and worked for Argosy for a while.
You taught higher ed related courses, correct?
That was all higher ed. So I taught, so totally missed that, right? Like, so in 2004 was my first foray into online. Mm-hmm. I taught history courses online with Angel Software through a technical college in Fort Myers. And I think that was kind of like, so when I was in this education world, having that outside, like getting back into the higher education community, teaching and stuff. And I've really, since 2004, I've always had at least one like adjunct job, about one like something every year.
Still
doing. Yeah. 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 Like even like this semester, coming up at Lincoln, I'm going to teach the community college, here, but so I taught at Kaplan as an adjunct, I did history first with them. I designed their African-American history course. Then when I got my doctorate, I taught for them in their master's in higher ed program, and I was responsible for one of their other courses. I taught at Ashford. I taught at American International College. Right, is that right? American International AIC, I think. So yeah,
own my jealousy. That's one thing I have not done. I've done little stints, a little bit of teaching. I'd like to do more in that online adjunct space. Whether it's, I mean, my American history background with my master's is very rusty, but in a higher ed space, I'd love to. But so I'm going to own my jealousy.
Yeah, I mean, I like it. I mean, it. I've always enjoyed the classroom, and I enjoy teaching, probably more so than the administration of higher ed. But I would never be a faculty member. Like, I just don't have that. That desire went away a long time ago to just do that. Because even like the 2 years that I was at Argosy as a faculty member wasn't my bliss. Like, that wasn't like, it was fun and I enjoyed it, but it's not like, oh my, I want this is all I want to do for the rest of my career. And so then, you know, kind of took like, that was like a two year kind of like Kevin, find yourself, what do you want to do? And then happened to come across a job at Pearson, which was for online programs, but it was really, I always look at it more like it was really more about strategy, like structure, organization. How do you get faculty to buy into online? I've other than teaching, I would say, you know, I am not a curriculum person. I'm not into the pedagogy of online, like the instruction aspects, like how to structure and stuff. Like, can I talk about it? Yes.
Scholarship of teaching and learning.
Yeah. I mean, that's just not where I fit more in the strategy and the planning, mm-hmm. enrollment management, organizational structures. And so I think that's where, you know, my role, you know, in online now is a lot different probably than a lot of other colos that maybe came through that instructional design process, or they were, you know, they're more closely aligned to their, you know, instructional designers. I mean, instructional designers don't even report to me, you know, at Nebraska.
So they don't report to you?
No, they don't. No. But for me, it's more about like the strategy. Like, what are we doing? Like, how are we going to integrate these non-credit things into curriculum? Like, how do we help our students get further down the road? I've always looked at everything from that enrollment management, student success lens, right? And I think Pearson really kind of drove this home for me. It was always the student first. Everything is from like, you design and you build for what the student is looking for. And then you go out. You don't come from a faculty and push what they think the students want. You got to go the other way. And so having that lens of reversing things and kind of going out that way. But so, I mean, I think, you know, I was just going to say, I mean, I think that's kind of like, that's my path. Definitely it's not a traditional path in this space. And again, I think that has both personal challenges for me, but I also think it's things that, and when I say personal challenges for me, it's just like, I love what I do. So I don't want anybody that's at Lincoln to hear this and like, you know, Kevin's not satisfied in his job. I love what I do. I struggle just with the day-to-day of, I like to see things happen. And so it's hard to wait. I have a hard time waiting for things to get to where you think they should be.
Yeah, I agree with you. My wife makes fun of me because I'll watch movies that I've watched in the past, which is fine. And then because of streaming, right? Like I love fast forwarding to scenes because I only want to see. So there's a part of me that's just very like expedient, right? Like,
yeah,
let's get to it. Let's go. And it's tough to balance that need with the pace of higher ed, which, you know, we don't want to necessarily put every school, every community college, every university in that bucket.
Yeah.
But I almost feel like even the more innovative institutions, it's like, again, being in the matrix, right? Like you can do certain things that are cool, but at the end of the day, we're all kind of trapped in a system that is still very slow to change. And how can we kind of do our day to day, but then always be thinking about other things that need to get done that still helps us to recharge our batteries and allows us to be almost kind of like marathon runners, right? Where we know that there's an end inside. We just need to kind of pace more to eventually get to that finish line.
But we want to be like elite marathoners, right? Where you're at a really high pace. We're getting there, but we're getting there faster, but it's still right. long distance. I mean, to me, yeah. Right now, higher ed is being forced to make so many changes. And I'm not going to say they're all great reasons. Even the demographic ones would push change. And this mm-hmm. is a sector, industry, whatever you want to call it. But that's the demand has been there for so long, since post-war. They didn't have to change because such an expansion of students wanting to come. Then the college going rate went up. Then, you know, it was just always there. You could dictate things like, mm-hmm. no, we're going to structure it for the way we see it rather than for you as a student. Now, you know, as students become more scarce for all the reasons their scarcity is growing, demographic and otherwise, institutions are really seeing that you have to, it's not just give them what they want, but meet them where they are more so than say in the 60s, 70s or 80s, whenever.
Yeah. And you don't have to be everything to everyone all the time, right? Like you yep. can, right? Like find what you're really good at, where you have expertise, find those partnerships as well. So that you're not carrying the load always by yourself. Yeah.
Yeah. I think, you know, it's interesting when you look back historically in higher ed, the shifts of like the for-profits coming into the scene made a huge difference in accessibility. You know, even though the community colleges were accessible, for-profits made this big difference. And then in the online space, like you look at that peak that we had in 2007 to 2010, and then all of a sudden it just wipes away. But what people don't, if you would take away all the for-profit enrollments from 2010, the declines are not as bad as like if you just look at that data. But yep. if you would wipe those out and say, well, okay, those didn't exist, they weren't enrollments, it's not that much. I mean, it's still a decline, but it's not the 15, 16, 17% we saw, because the majority of that was the for-profits, you know, that are not even here anymore. I mean, they just like fully closed. So,
and we could uncork a big can of worms. Do you think those closures or that contraction in the for-profit space, is that, was it warranted? Was it, oh, that's too bad. They shouldn't have. I mean, that's a whole topic we could dig into.
I think it's a topic that we should dig into, at least, you know, have some thoughts around it. I mean, I have some thoughts. I think a lot of it is political, and it's interesting how it flip-flops, right? Like we did gainful employment because that was to hurt basically the for-profits, but now we're doing gainful employment for everybody and no one has a rhyme or reason as to why we're doing it other than we want to hurt, you know, we don't want to give, basically now we don't want to give financial aid to any institution. And so we're going to make you meet these metrics versus before is like, we're going to make you meet these only if you're a certain category of school, so we can close you down. I think there was some regulation, regulatory issues, right? Like how did we end up with so many for-profits? Were the accrediting bodies doing what the accrediting bodies needed to do for all of these institutions? Was it too much growth too fast? But I would say, I mean, I don't know if you were in that conversation or not, but we were talking about University of Phoenix at UPSIA. I don't think badly about University of Phoenix. I think the issue is University of Phoenix has just been lumped in with these other players, but ASU wouldn't be where ASU is without University of Phoenix. Many of us in the online space would not be where we were without the accessibility that the University of Phoenix put forward for mm-hmm. a large population of students. Like I still say this, and this is where I'll end. Walden University still graduates more females, more African-American females with a doctorate degree than any other university in the United States.
Hmm.
That statement should be wrong. But we as higher ed are okay with it because that's, I must say it. I don't think all of higher ed is yet to be inclusive. And I think the for-profits created inclusivity that we're missing in the rest of higher ed.
Yeah.
I agree with what you're saying. There's a lot of nuance there. If you look at, default rates, earnings of graduates, and et cetera.
Yeah.
Non-completers and outstanding debt.
Yeah.
But their openness for people to get in, pushed boundaries. And I mean, I think the Dear Colleague letter 2011, opening the gates to OPMs, especially, it really juiced that whole dynamic. And a lot in the for-profits' favor, because they were ready to pounce on that. They saw an opportunity to pounce.
Yeah.
College Inc. is still one of my favorite documentaries about higher ed, because it just shows you, the for-profit model at its height, right? And then, of course, we know the rest of the story after that.
Yeah.
So as we wrap up here, tell us, as we asked with Kelvin, that's a lot about your work, and there's a lot of personal stuff in there, but what do you like to do? Not just what do you do, what do you like to do?
So Angela and I like to go camping, spending time outdoors. Outside of that, I mean, I started playing golf again for the first time in about 10 years. So I'm hoping to get back into playing golf. But we also have a grandson. Our daughter had a baby. He's 2.5 years old, little Leo. I think now is having a little bit more family time from a different perspective. But camping is probably like the biggest thing. And then just spending time with our children and their spouses as often as we can.
I bet you have a list of places you've camped that is enviable.
So I don't know that we've camped a lot of places. So I didn't share these. Like I have been to every state in the United States. I have traveled. I mean, I've lived in Europe and went to every free country in Europe that we could go to when I lived there. My wife and I have been to Ireland 4 times, and we're going again in September. Like, so having, those types of things, but I enjoy, like, we've been to Yellowstone. I'm not camping, but I mean, just the national parks. I think the whole national park system, state park systems in states, I think, are a missed opportunity for people.
Oh yeah.
To get out and see. But, yeah, I mean, hopefully start to do a little bit more camping in some other places that we haven't been to, but it's fun. Glamping is what my wife says, right? Because we have a travel trailer.
So, oh, you do? Okay, yeah. Because the
very first time my wife and I went camping was actually in Branson, Missouri.
Yeah.
We went to Silver Dollar City, and we had a tent. But it's funny, we were driving back from Kansas just recently, back to Florida. And both, like, I asked her, I was like, when you think of Branson, what do you think of? And she's like, the trip that we took when we went camping. Like it was the best time. So camping, whitewater rafting.
Oh yeah.
I mean,
you've been to a whitewater rafting conference. That's one thing you shouldn't hold back.
I did. That was amazing. That's a story for another day. I think that would be a good story for another day. That was good, but yeah.
Well, I guess we're going to sign off. So thank you everybody for listening to Getting Stuff Done in Higher Education. And we will be back with another episode very soon.